This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome back to A Complete History of Manchester United. I'm your host, Wayne Barton, author and producer of several Manchester United books and films, joined as always by the legendary football writer, Paddy Barclay, author of several Manchester United books, several football books, in fact. Relevantly for this series, of course, author of the definitive biography of Sir Matt Busby, biographies of Jose Mourinho, Alex Ferguson as well in there, for your reading delight. We are taking you on this journey through Old Trafford history. If you're watching the video, please give it a like and subscribe. Join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. So Manchester United season, Paddy, 72-73, kickoff. The pre-season is in the South Coast. They play a couple of games down there and then they move on to Denmark and Germany. What do you feel the feeling? I mean, they finished eighth for a few seasons in a row.
Yeah.
Franco Farrell's got his feet under the table. He's got a couple of players in there. He's got the promise of more money to spend if he needs it. What do you think the ambitions would have been for Frank looking forward?
Yeah, onwards and upwards. I mean, it wasn't to turn out that way, but I think, by and large, he knew he had a fight on his hand. But you know, with this aging great side of 5 years earlier that had won the European Cup, with Matt Busby, you know, still on the scene and still casting a shadow, however inadvertently. So I don't think Frank O'Farrell and Malcolm Musgrove's assistant would have been comfortable. But, you know, this was Manchester United. He'd left Leicester City to progress to the next level. So, yes, he would have been looking to what would now be called a Europa League slot, definitely.
Yeah, he'd be looking, you would have thought, maybe top five, top six.
Yes.
They wouldn't have been... Obviously, I don't think anyone at Old Trafford was believing that they were ready for a title challenge. But
no.
At the same time, they were, you know, the hope with every blank page of a new season is that you're going to kick on from where you were before.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, events that, and they weren't helped by a few problems at the start of the season. The first rumbling of discontent was a comment from Brian Clough, who said something like, "No one has a chance at Old Trafford while Sir Matt is likely to appear around the corner." And again, he wasn't blaming Busby for that. He was like, that's a natural consequence of Busby being around. He wasn't saying that Busby was appearing. He was like, while Busby's still employed, while he's still around the club.
Yeah.
You can have that problem.
That was true. I think it was, you know, it was a comment that has been vindicated by the passing years. But it is also true that Sir Matt and Brian Clough were very different people. Sir Matt did not like the brashness of this guy. And of course, the previous season, they had clashed very publicly when Ian Story Moore was seduced out of Brian Clough's clutches by Sir Matt. So, and was by now at Manchester United. We or actually since we've mentioned Ian Storey more, it didn't help this 72-3 season from Manchester United's point of view, nor did it help Ian Storey Moore's career that he'd sustained an injury in training at the Cliff that was eventually to really put paid to what was a very, very exciting career.
Yeah. Not helped as well by the fact that other players were unavailable for different kinds of reasons. Dennis Law still struggling with his knee injury, but dropped by O'Farrell, as was Bobby Charlton at the start of the season. It began disastrously. United lose against Ipswich on the opening day. They lose at Liverpool and then at Everton, a Merseyside double blow. O'Farrell taking the decision to drop Charlton, which is the headline one, really. Not so much Dennis Law because of the injury problems.
Yeah.
Not helped by the fact that George Best, who has returned from Marbella, but hasn't really trained in pre-season and didn't play any of the pre-season games. So he's already playing catch-up with that. He's obviously needing firepower in the front line. He wants to shake it up, but tries to do that by dropping Bobby Charlton. This creates a conflict, a function at the club, right, where O'Farrell's wife, Anne, is caught in a confrontation with Busby, where Busby had said something to Anne, but almost off the cuff, like, I wouldn't have made that decision. And then Anne bit back at him. And this sort of played out over the next coming weeks, and O'Farrell was obviously very unhappy. And having that sense of feeling, especially with this blank slate of a new season, wanting to kick on and move forward. But you mentioned earlier in the there was this distrust of Busby, and that was emphasized basically by what had happened there. Not only had the season only just begun, Busby's straight in there, like making a comment, however, you know, innocent that remark was at a club function, but O'Farrell's back was definitely up with that.
I mean, I think an example of the sort of disconnect between various factions at the club was, and the fact that O'Farrell was being undermined, was that David Meek, who's appeared a lot in this podcast, the late David Meek, the perennial correspondent, United correspondent of the Manchester Evening News, decided to go into print with a piece. I mean, bear in mind that, as you've rightly said, United's form was dismal. I mean, as winter was closing in, they were relegation candidates. I mean, serious relegation candidates. And David sensed that O'Farrell wasn't being supported enough. Just as, you know, perhaps he wrote a piece saying Wilf McGuinness was given 18 months. Now we've had just about 18 months of Frank O'Farrell. That's not enough. A manager needs more time than that. That was what he wrote. Anyways, called in by the club. I don't know whether it was Matt or somebody else, but he was told, ticked off and accused of wanting to embarrass, that was the word, embarrass Manchester United. And later, David told me that he suspected, he couldn't understand, well, what do you mean embarrass Manchester United? Why does he embarrass Manchester United to say the manager needs more time? Because the decision had probably already been made that O'Farrell wasn't the man any more than Wilf was.
Yeah.
Not David Meek's fault, he just wrote an honest opinion piece. But the prickly reaction of Matt and the board told its, in retrospect, was telling its own story.
Yeah. There was another piece in one of the national newspapers as well where, I think it was in the Mirror, a United fan who wrote for the Mirror, a United fan, a United supporter, supporting journalist, he'd written something like, what is happening to my club? But obviously, as Meek, as a local reporter, is more likely to be called in.
Manchester United did. David was, a tradition had been established after Munich, I think, that, well, David joined the paper. They joined the Manchester Evening News because his predecessor had been killed at Munich. But David was sort of semi-embedded into Manchester United. Yeah. He travelled with the team, he stayed in the same hotel and so on. But, and as you say, they felt proprietary, they felt they could tick him off. They couldn't call in the guy from the Mirror.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't accorded the same privileges. But basically, those privileges that David had enjoyed between 1958 and 1972 were withdrawn because of his article. Yeah. You're not traveling with the team anymore. Fine. He went to his editor. His editor said, you know, how do I reply? Do you want me to be conciliatory to Manchester United, or do you want me to tell them to, I won't say the word that he said, but go away. And David said, try and just do something down the middle, you know, typical David conciliatory attitude. But that was it. That was the end of 15 years in which David had been not only a chronicler of the club, but a sort of a friend as well.
Yeah. Around that time, he just started doing the Manchester United books, like an annual Manchester United football book. And they did continue for some time. So he obviously continued with plenty of good access, but like you said, nowhere near as intimately as he'd enjoyed previously, which for David would have been a proper indulgence as well because of the fact that he loved United.
He did. So
he got close to them. But United were lucky as well to have David. Let's put that on record as well. They were definitely lucky to have him. And when he was speaking from the heart. And everything that he was saying, the concerns he was showing were true, because even as we go forward, the first 18 months under O'Farrell's successor, as we'll get to, were disastrous. So it proves the point. You need more than 18 months to see even start to begin to do that work. So we mentioned the other players. Charlton dropped, Lowe dropped. Eventually, they both recalled. George Best doesn't get dropped this time round. He sort of loses his way of his own regard. In the opening game of the season against Ipswich, the Ipswich defenders are commenting on how easy it is to mark George out of the game because he's so rusty. He's had this summer off. He's nowhere near match fit. And they were almost embarrassed after the game talking about it because he didn't want to throw George under the bus, but they were commenting on it. You know, it was easy to play against him. Remember, this is the same Ipswich team of recent seasons where George had embarrassed them, scoring from a corner and then almost doing it again. So much so that he was taking the mick out of Bobby Robson on the sidelines, and now his fall from grace is so significant. But he's still in the team. He scores his first goal against Leicester. But United, it's four goalless games from the first six games. So prompts O'Farrell into the transfer market. Another journalist reckons that it's going to cost United £1 million to solve the problems. The reality is it's probably going to cost somewhere between 1 and 2 million because of the number of reinforcements needed. David Nish, the defender, has just moved to Derby for near £250,000, £225,000. So United are going to need seven or eight players of that kind of calibre, really.
O'Farrell spent £250,000 on two strikers, Wyn Davies from there was very much a sort of little and large combination. There was Wyn Davies, who was fantastic in the air, who came across the town from Manchester City for a relatively modest 25,000. Ted McDougall, who was a real predator, a proven goal scorer at a certain level with Bournemouth, he cost £220,000. So there's a quarter of that notional £1 million budget gone on strikers. These are people who have the extraordinarily difficult task of trying to replace the likes of Charlton and Law. good luck with that. But even with that, those two new strikers, United's form remained dismal and approaching Christmas, right as far as Christmas,
They both scored a fair amount of goals at the start, both scoring in the early days. Davies coming in as a, you would say, de facto replacement for Lowe, because Lowe was breaking down so often that he was the veteran expected to come in. So he wasn't ever a long-term gamble on Davies. It was a short-term kind of fix. Whereas McDougall, we'll get to him in due course, but he come from Bournemouth, where he'd been a prolific goal scorer in the lower reaches. And basically, the one thing that had shown to prominence was he'd scored 9 goals in a cup game for Bournemouth. So every eye in the land was on him to see how well he was doing, but no one would take the gamble on him until a team needed to take a gamble on him, which was Manchester United. And McDougall, because of the fact he cost this amount of money and because of the fact that, you know, he had this reputation where someone had to take a gamble at some point, someone had to take the punt, he was very much the forefront figure at United. Not like Davies, McDougall was expected to hit the ground running, and he was given all the fanfare of a top signing and everything like that. So he was very much expected to be the saviour for O'Farrell, or so he would hope. O'Farrell doing a lot of internal things as well, like he had Malcolm Musgrove draw lots to try and change the hotel arrangements, so different people would be staying with different people, to try and break up cliques. But it wasn't working. The form was dreadful. There was no win in the first 9 games. A 4-1 home defeat to Spurs as well. But he kept going, O'Farrell. Davies and McDougall both scored in a win over Liverpool, which he thought was going to be a turning point, because then they again did it in a win over Southampton a week or so later. Now, Best had started to go missing from training. So O'Farrell dropped him. He dropped him for the trip to Norwich, where United win. So that was 3 wins in 4 games. O'Farrell's got this little, tiny little run of momentum where he feels vindicated in dropping Best, vindicated in the players that he's brought in. So he puts Best on the transfer list. Unfortunately for O'Farrell, at the same time as he's notifying the press of that, Louis Edwards is telling the press that, because someone's gone to Louis Edwards about it and said, oh, what's this about George Best being on the transfer list? He says, no, George Best is not for sale. So it's already showing that they're not on the same page. So no Charlton, no Best, no Lowe. Well, Lowe is fit enough to be third choice behind O'Farrell's new strikers. He needs the results to go his way desperately at this moment in time, because that's the thing that he's clinging to. Now the results need to keep going. But United lose 2-0 to Stoke at Old Trafford. It's a very dismal performance, and the writing already appears to be on the wall. Like you said, United are in the relegation fight. They're in the bottom places. They're really looking like they're going to go down. They go to Crystal Palace, who are fellow strugglers who do go on to get relegated. That's not too much of a spoiler. They go to Crystal Palace and they lose by 5 just before Christmas. It's a shocking defensive performance. One of those performances. You spoke about David Meek commenting on 18 months and how, you know, we need time for managers. But sometimes there are individual defeats. People watching this will be familiar with United losing 5-0 to Liverpool at Old Trafford. Sometimes an individual result can change the entire landscape.
4-0 to Brighton.
Exactly.
There
are plenty of those to pick from in recent years.
We're talking now in 2022. You know, how many, for 50 years on from the season we're actually discussing, and nearly 50 years on. And, you know, for youngsters, those 2 defeats in the 21-22 season, if you multiply them by 2, you get an idea of the defensive performance against Crystal Palace as the Christmas of 1972 approached. It was a total shambles against the team, as you rightly say, that were destined for relegation. It was, however, although a painful match from the Manchester United point of view, it was to be a momentous one.
Yeah, it really was a terrible defensive display. I mean, you can, the highlights of that all over YouTube if you wish to purvey them. We covered that for in the film Too Good to Go Down, with that the highlights of the lowlights of that match are there, and you can tell Alex Stepney looks absolutely bereft, shot of confidence and shot of confidence in the players around him to do basics right, because the goals are shambolic. The way you wouldn't even expect them conceded by third division sides. United are all over the place. There's no way out for O'Farrell, basically. You couldn't imagine that he could turn the situation around anyway, but it just so happens, conveniently for United, that the wheels are already motion. Like you said, first of all, the decision pretty much had already been taken anyway. But secondly, Tommy Docherty was in, who was a Scotland manager, was in the director's box.
That's absolutely right. And he was, Tommy Docherty had taken over as Scotland manager, made a very good impression there immediately. He'd, as, you know, as we know, he'd made his name at Chelsea before. And he, in the course of his duties as Scotland manager, the reason he was at Selhurst Park that day was to watch Scotland candidates such as Law, who was still rated highly enough by Tommy as to be a prospect, and Willie Morgan, who throughout United's decline, you know, had retained good personal form. And they, and this is an interesting one, they'd already, those two players, had already been approached by Busby and asked what they thought of Tommy Docherty as a manager. Well, certainly Willie was to change his opinion in later years, but that's for another day. But, you know, the word came back. We think he's great. We think he's fantastic. So at any rate, he's there at Selhurst Park, and Matt, who moves in not so mysterious ways, said, "I'd like you to meet someone," and introduced him to Louis Edwards, Matt's friend and United chairman. They, Edwards said, "You know, how would you feel about it? Being manager of Manchester United?" Well, Docherty was a friend of, liked O'Farrell personally, and said, "Well, you've already got a manager." Only to be told that within a few days, we won't have a manager, so there will be a vacancy. So, you know, that was that die was already cast. Docherty then resolved, yeah, much as I like being Scotland manager, I'm not going to turn down Manchester United. Yes, I will take it. So that when duly, within a few days, O'Farrell was sacked, the final betrayal, they already, Docherty had already put his departure from Scotland in train. Scotland, the Scottish FA had given permission for him to leave. And that was it. Manchester United had a new boss.
Yeah, O'Farrell sacked, Musgrove went with him, and most shockingly, actually, John Aston was sacked at the same time, which upset a lot of players who'd come up through John, and they were very unhappy to see John go, and upset John Junior.
This is John Aston, John Aston Senior, as Junior had already gone, been transferred to Luton. Yeah, and as you rightly say, a very upsetting moment in the history of Manchester United, because John Aston, you know, he played in the 48 Cup final. He was almost synonymous with the Busby era, always there, either as a player or in various backroom roles. So, yeah, the times were a-changing.
Yeah. Docherty, renowned for being straight to the punch with straight to the punchline. Often a wisecracking manager, really befitting of the profile. He, you know, he walked into Old Trafford full of confidence. On his first day at the club, he went onto the pitch and just hummed to himself, "You were made for me, I was made for you." And it's funny, looking back, and you mentioned the Scotland gig and the way that he walked out of that. And effectively, the words were a variation of this, you know, "United is the only job that I would leave Scotland for."
Yeah.
And he loved the idea of being Manchester United manager and what he was to do with Manchester United and the vision that he would, you know, eventually, I don't think it's telling any spoilers to say that he complete that vision to a certain extent. Now, obviously, because of what happened afterwards, he always spoke not in dull tones about United, but it was almost like he didn't love United as much as he did because of what United eventually did to him. Mm-hmm. But from these early stages, you could tell that he really did love United. And I'm not, this, as this podcast will tell, and as we go on to some notes in this podcast, we're definitely not a revisionist podcast. Well, we like to tell it as it is, even if it is ruining Wilf McGuinness's stories or statistical anomalies, as I'm going to go on to in this episode. So I don't like to revise it and say that it wasn't what it was, or, you know, that it was, that it wasn't. But Tommy did love United, and I wish that he, even in my conversations with him, I'm sure that you had the same conversation sometimes, right? That some of that, I wouldn't say bitterness, because obviously he led a full and happy life, but some of that resentment that was still there from the way that he was treated or the way that he felt that he was treated. Sometimes yes. I wish that we'd seen something else of Tommy that, you know, where he could, I mean, he always confessed his love for his team and his players, but never the club in the same way. And it seemed a shame because what he was to United and what he did do was obviously, we'll come to, some of it was quite, we might say, beyond the pale, but he did seem to come through a love of the actual profile of the club and wanting to mould it in his own image, while still being somewhat faithful to its history as well.
He was, he really was sort of hand in glove. I can remember his time at Manchester United. Looking back on it, he was at home, you know. I remember him. You know, if you were at an away match, you'd go into the hotel and invariably in the lobby would be a huge pot of tea with Tommy sort of sitting there like a king on his throne. And funnily enough, one guy who was always with him was the physiotherapist, Laurie Brown.
Yeah.
They were great friends. I'm trying to resist the spoiler at this stage. So, well, let's move on. But, you know, he and his assistant, Tommy Cavanagh, and we can talk about Tommy Cavanagh later if you like. But those three, Cav, as he was called, the dog, and Laurie would be sitting with a great big pot of tea watching the world go by. And honestly, Tommy just seemed such a perfect fit for Manchester United.
Yeah. I don't think it is revisionist either to, when you look at the profile of Tommy and you look at his era, after Sir Alex and Sir Matt, I still maintain that the, maybe not successful in terms of trophies, but the most synonymous from any manager with Manchester United, or the most identifiable, most beloved side, is the Tommy Doherty Manchester United side, more than Atkinson, certainly more than any of the recent Sir Alex successors. Well, it's an argument there to be had, for sure, but it would take some time to come into effect. A difficult start for Tommy, but eventually, as he spent January spending money, the Tottenham Army impact. So obviously there was already an existing presence, an existing Scottish presence at United right from the top through the squad. Doherty made that even more so. He'd been appointed, or he'd been given Paddy Crerand as his assistant, which he was happy with at the start. Again, you mentioned Willie Morgan.
Textbook stuff, isn't it? You get someone who's, you know, embedded in the club, a part of the club's furniture, as your assistant. It's Jose Mourinho did it at Chelsea with Steve Clarke and so on. I mean, that's just one of millions that come to mind. It's sensible. You know, it's good to have a touchstone like that. And Paddy was perfect for it, and, you know, obviously bent on having a coaching career, feeling he could contribute to the game beyond his playing career. So and fellow Scott, no brainer.
Also reinforced the squad with another, I think, nearly £500,000 spent in a matter of weeks, signing a number of Scottish players, and also Mick Martin, a midfielder. So Mick Martin had impressed in a friendly, so he was duly signed. George Graham from
Austin. There were two Irish, weren't there? There was Mick Martin and Gerry Daly, both bargain buys who were to have quite an impact on Manchester United's first team, I think. And the four Scots, it was like a Celtic fringe, more than a fringe, more like a Beatle haircut, actually. And the most significant was Lou McCarrie.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly the doc had looked at Davis and McDougall and thought, right, okay, I need a striker. And he'd gone to Celtic for... back to Celtic, which had provided Crerand many years earlier, and bought Lou McCarrie, you know, a guarantee, a guy who'd grown up with Kenny Dalglish, you know, one of the most impressive breakout players at Celtic in recent years. So that was no problem. George Graham was another Scot who came. And I'm trying to think of the other two. Jim Holton would be one. That was a clever signing from Shrewsbury. Yeah. Big Jim, 6'2", eyes of blue, Holton. And the other one would the other one be? McCallion?
McCallion's a little later.
I beg your pardon. Alex Forsyth, right back from Partick Thistle. Very decent going forward. He'd been capped. I think he'd been first capped by the doc in Scotland quite recently. Good-looking player, you know. Very attacking right back. Comfortable on the ball. Decent tackle on him. So these looked... He looked like a Manchester United player, certainly at first. And George Graham, of course, you got a bit of elegance, a bit of style, a bit of nous there. And then, of course, Jim Holton, who was to become really as popular as a fan's favourite.
Yeah, absolutely. For you mentioned all of those players there. For different reasons, they've become hugely popular, apart from George Graham. We'll come on to that. But for Scythe, you mentioned... very good on the ball, very tenacious. And that tenacity was a very key ingredient that hadn't been in the O'Farrell United side, because there wasn't a ferocious midfielder, so to speak. So when he brought in Mick Martin as well, when Docherty brought in Mick Martin, he had a little bit of bite in midfield. But Holton certainly in the defence, and Forsyth at right back, two key areas which had desperately needed strengthening. And obviously, for probably... 2 years, United had been probably since Crerand retired. United had been operating without a proper central midfielder. So to get Graham in and Martin, Graham seemed like a very sensible signing. But again, one of those where United had probably missed a beat, because Alan Ball just gone to Arsenal, which had necessitated Graham's move to United. Ball's father was a United season ticket holder, so Ball was a United fan. He'd been brought up in that way. So United, if they wanted to make that move, as I'm pretty sure that O'Farrell intimated that he did want to make that move, and McGuinness before him had kind of tried to sound out a move for Alan Ball. If they'd have been more persevered, if they'd have persevered with that move, they would have probably got Ball over the line, but for whatever reason, they didn't, and they've ended up with George Graham. Nevertheless, once this new group of players settles, United do also suffer the... problem with Sammy McElroy, who in January has a car crash, which punctures his lung. For a moment there, it looks like he might even lose his life, but he punctures a lung. He's out for the rest of the season. So once they've got over this difficulty, and once the Scottish lads and the two Irish are bedded in, although Daly doesn't make his debut until the following season, United do have an upturn in form. Docherty is playing a little bit safer. There's a nominal 4-3-3, but he tries to make it a 4-4-2, which is a flat 4-4-2. It's functional. It works. United win 8 games from 12. And when you look at the table, considering the relegated team goes down on 32, oh, sorry, on 30, I think it is, and United get 37 points, those wins are desperately needed. The two results are really key. They win in the return game against Palace, who do go down, and they win in a tense game over Norwich just before that. So that's a space of 4 or 5 days in April, which basically secures safety for United. That compact shape has really helped United keep some clean sheets at a time when they desperately need it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Then with that in the bag, let's say in the bag, safety in the bag, United have just about crept up to 18th in the table, so they've staved off relegation. Doherty is left with two key decisions to make. The decisions that O'Farrell was never allowed to make. But we should also mention, on the same day that O'Farrell was sacked, George Best, who'd been on the transfer list, even though like United were willing to take him off it. And there was lots of rumours about who would come in to sign him, such as Derby County, which would have been a very interesting move indeed for George Best. But he didn't go there. He actually handed in a letter of resignation to the club, saying I quit on George Best headlined paper, as one would expect with a flourish. So yeah, he actually showed a lot of culpability in this letter, which he delivered personally to the board, saying I feel like I've let you down, kind of thing, and I can't be my best. That kind of thing was in the letter, and it was publicised everywhere. That's a thing that you can find everywhere, that letter. The contents of it aren't confidential by any means. Best admitting that, you know, he wasn't as dedicated as he was, and he'd lost his way, and that United would be better off without him. So he was gone for the second half of the season. He was basically gone from the game for good, as far as everyone knew. He was going to retire, although there were a few sceptics in the press saying, oh, he'll be back because of what happened in Spain the previous summer. But certainly for the second half of this season, no George Best at Manchester United, no George Best under Tommy Docherty. He was living, you know, he's contracted to the club, but he wasn't there. The decision that Docherty did have to face was with Bobby Charlton and Dennis Lowe. Now, Bobby Charlton made the decision easier. And Docherty had a bit of a conflict over this, didn't he? Because Charlton went to Docherty and said that he intended to retire anyway, so he was going to be gone at the end of the season. In retrospect, Docherty has lamented the fact that he didn't fight harder to keep him as his assistant, although that would have probably upset the apple cart with Creran. You never know with Docherty anyway whether or not he was saying that through sentimental hindsight, or, you know, like with the benefit of hindsight, for sure. But it definitely seemed to be something that he did think about, that he should have offered Charlton a job on the staff. But the Dennis Lowe one was a lot more controversial. Charlton basically retired. He had this big fanfare at the end of the season against Chelsea, where his retirement from Manchester United was, he retired as top scorer as well, 7 goals, which is another matter. But Charlton retired at the end of a great Manchester United career. Dennis Lowe was initially told he'd be kept on to see out. He had a year left on his contract, right, Paddy? And he was told he'd be able to see that out, only to return home for pre-season to Aberdeen, switched on Grandstand, and was informed by the host of Grandstand that he'd been given a free transfer from Manchester United. So in the space of a few weeks, Charlton and Lowe both gone from United. How seismic was that at the time?
Yeah, well, it was the not as seismic as, because everybody realised that Docherty was building, and Docherty was taking on the task that maybe Frank O'Farrell hadn't been able to perform. You know, this ruthless surgery. Because, you know, make no mistake, it was all three of the, what was it, Holy Trinity or whatever it was called, Lowe, Best and Charlton. Docherty had privately washed his hands of George Best at this stage. So all three were gone. Not only that, David Sadler, only 27, but a veteran of the European Cup winning team. He was being bombed out as well. He was training with the kids. So Doherty's surgery verged on the ruthless, you know, which was needed. And he was able to do it because, unlike O'Farrell, Doherty was able to play Louis Edwards. Doherty was able to dominate, perhaps is the wrong word, but Doherty was able to get his way with Louis Edwards in a way that nobody since Matt had been able to do. He really, he behaved like a Ferguson, you know, like a proper controlling manager. That was Doherty's. Doherty had the charisma and the strength of personality to do that. So the job that had needed to be done for a long, long time, Doherty didn't shirk it. And this was, so to that extent, it wasn't a seismic as you might think now, looking back. Oh, Best and Charlton, three Ballon d'Or winners. You know, being, you know, turfed out of the club. It didn't quite seem like that because they were faded forces. Well, George was because he wasn't there. Dennis because he was injured and aging. And Bobby simply because time had caught up with him. And he had thought, you know, I want to go into management. He'd had the offer from Preston North End and decided to take it, which incidentally became a solution for David Sadler, because the following season, Charlton was to bring, was to end Sadler's misery by taking him to Preston North End.
Yeah, Tony Dunn would also be moved on. Perhaps, and he had a couple of years good in him, still in there.
So there's another European Cup. So that's half the European Cup side gone in a matter of months.
Yeah, it's just incredible turnover. Like you said, though, the idea of it being a seismic thing, Doherty as well, it should be said that the Edwards and Busby realised that one manager would have to be given the responsibility of doing this. He couldn't avoid it forever. One manager would have to oversee it. And maybe that was one thing they'd come to an agreement privately over, the fact that because O'Farrell had tried to make this change and it hadn't worked for O'Farrell, I think possibly Busby and Edwards realised that the next man would have to be able to oversee that transition. And
in fact, yes, that's true, because there is sort of anecdotal evidence for this sort of voluntary transfer of power that you're describing, in that David Sadler remained bitter about this for years, and rightly so, because he'd been sort of promised a testimonial. Doherty said that Tony Dunn's would be the last testimonial. That's it. And Sadler was advised, well, go to Matt. He promised you it. He'll sort you out. And Matt said, no, I can't interfere. So the penny had finally dropped with Matt. From now on, I'm not sort of helping the manager. I'm not showing the manager the ropes. The manager is Tommy Doherty. I'm just the director. So that finally, that sort of cord had been snapped.
Yeah. Doherty steers United to 18th, which would have been unthinkable even 12 months earlier, really, that United would be in that kind of dogfight. But that's where they were. And 18th, from Doherty's starting position, was actually a decent job, what he'd done, especially that good run of 8 wins in 12. So they were looking up. In the Cups, United had been knocked out early. Bristol Rovers in the League Cup at the second stage for United, after overcoming a replay in the in the first attempt, knocked out in a replay to Bristol, and then Wolves in the third round in the FA Cup knocked United out. They also, United participated in a series of games that aren't in the official records padded. The Anglo-Italian Cup, they played against Fiorentina, Lazio, Bari, and Verona as well. Charlton actually scored twice in the 4-1 win over Verona. Technically, his last game for the club. I obviously know a lot of United historians. There's one Tony, man called Tony, who will argue until he's blue in the face that the Anglo-Italian Cup should be included in the club's official records because it's a senior cup competition, which is included in every other club's official records. So Charlton, who retired from United on 7-4-9 appearances and 2-4-9 goals, it's actually something like 7-5-3 and 2-5-1. And if you think that that's insignificant, first of all, it's not insignificant because it's Charlton's official United record. But second of all, United made a big deal out of Ryan Giggs succeeding that on, and the when he succeeded that appearance record was when United won the European Cup in Moscow. That was the day Giggs broke that appearance record. He levelled it by scoring in the league win in 2008 and then surpassed it by coming on as a substitute in Moscow. And that's what the club recognised. However, if these records should stand, as one would presume that they should, because they were competitive games United played, there's no reason. It wasn't like the Watney Cup or anything. It was an Anglo-Italian Cup, which was an established competition, international competition. Yes. Effectively, that was Bobby Charlton's last game for the club, even though the club recognised it as Chelsea. Warier to put the record straight.
You're too young to remember, but my recollection was that the Anglo-Italian Cup was disparaged, but was treated as it wasn't a friendly.
Yeah,
and I think that's the criterion. Some might argue that it was somewhere in between a competitive match and a friendly. But when you consider that, take a look at the teams, you've probably got the lineups for the Anglo-Italian Cup. My recollection is that these were first team fixtures. Yeah. And as you say, if the other clubs treated them as official games, maybe Manchester United should too.
The Charity Shield is a perfect example. That gets counted on the official records, so there's no reason why.
That's a very good criterion. I mean, you know, the Charity Shield at the time we are talking about was you would play your full first team in. Now, of course, you probably use about nearly 20 players in the Charity Shield, but it's still treated as a serious match. Yeah. And as an official match, and yes, I fall down on your side that the Anglo-Italian Cup should be included in the official record. Yeah.
Okay, let's. So we've got United out of the cups in the early stages and finishing 18th in the league. Let's go through the squad stats like we always do. I'll put Tommy Dock on the screen there because we've got to give him his little hello. And that's his presentation before the game against Leeds United, which wasn't his official first game in charge. That would come against Derby County a few days later, where United would lose 3-1, the size of the task. Although Story most scored in that defeat, so one little rankle for Brian Clough.
But
Derby went on to win and enjoyed a much better season than United for sure. So, yeah, let's go through the team. The goalkeepers, Alex Stepney, is the first choice. 43 games in all competitions, 38 in the league. The other four league appearances are taken by Jimmy Rimmer, the standing goalkeeper, who is soon to move on. The defence, Martin Buchan, ever present in every single game, 47 games in all competitions, 42, of course, in the league. Ian Donald, we mentioned in the previous episode, he makes 5 appearances this season, 4 of those in the league. Tony Dunn makes his final 28 appearances for United, 24 of those in the league. Another of the squad defenders from the previous episodes that we've mentioned, Paul Edwards, makes 1 single appearance in the league. Tommy O'Neill makes 17 appearances, 16 of those in the league. Steve James makes 26 appearances, 22 of those in the league. David Sadler makes 22 appearances, 19 in the league. And then we bring none of those, by the way, scoring a goal, which is going to become a common unfortunately, through this Manchester United squad. Very low scoring season indeed, as indicated by the Bobby Charlton stats that I mentioned earlier. One player who did score was one of the new signings, Jim Holton, as we've already mentioned, and I'll bring him up now. Recommended to United by Harry Gregg, who was the manager of Shrewsbury at this point.
Mm-hmm.
6 foot two, eyes are blue, even though his eyes were brown. Mm-hmm. Again, bringing you the facts, not the the stories. Alton, with the kind of physicality not seen since Bill Foulkes and the aggression that neither Martin Buchan or David Sadler possessed, he was hugely popular because of that. He scored 3 goals in 15 league appearances, a really strong start to his time at the club. another defender, I should say, Arnie Sidebottom, makes 2 league appearances without scoring. Another of these sportsmen of multi-disciplines, more prominently remembered as a cricketer, of course. We spoke about cricketers and footballers at United in the past. Sidebottom, definitely one of those.
Not only a cricketer of great note himself, but the producer of Ryan Sidebottom, his son, who was, you know, an equally distinguished cricketer, if not more so.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. He made 2 appearances this season for United. Central defender, wiry in comparison to the colossal frame of Jim Alton.
Yes.
Came through the youth ranks, another lad from Barnsley. Very, very popular player, Arnie Sidebottom in the squad. Great sense of humour. The other players loved him. Brian Greenough absolutely adored him. But as we said, a much more talented cricketer as a bowler. But you've got to be talented as a footballer to make even a couple of appearances for Manchester United. So commend him for being an incredible sportsman in both regards. Mentioned Alex Forsyth earlier. Now, he makes 9 appearances this season, 8 of those in the league, as he will eventually become an accomplished right-back, but he makes his debut at left-back. He was assigned to address that right-back issue with O'Neill not being a strong enough competitor on that side. Signed, Paddy, for almost £100,000, which is a sizable transfer fee for a defender. He'd started his career at Arsenal as a junior before moving back to his motherland. But yeah, definitely a fullback of immense promise. And like you quite rightly mentioned, Docky had already given him his international bow, so he knew enough about him and was happy to have him in the squad. The other defenders in there, Tony Young, was the more prominent right back before the signing of Forsyth. He made 34 appearances, no competitions, 30 of those in League Two as a sub. And the other defender was Willie Watson, who we mentioned in a previous episode. He made 4 appearances, 3 of those in the league. Brings us on to the midfield. John Fitzpatrick makes 6 appearances, 5 of those in the league without scoring a single goal. Mick Martin, who we mentioned earlier, United were exercising their Irish links to sign Martin from Bohemians. He was, like we said, United needed energy and legs in the midfield, and Doherty was happy to have him. One of the first signings of the club. He'd already been an Irish international for a couple of years. He made 16 appearances this season, two of those as a sub in the league, but all of the appearances in the league, and 2 goals he scored as well. Sammy McElroy with 1 goal in 13 games. The goal came in the League Cup defeat, and 10 appearances in the league, 6 as a sub, as his acclimatisation to the first team was a little bit more gradual under O'Farrell than the prominent start he had the previous season, where obviously he made his debut scoring a few goals and then becoming a Northern Ireland international. A little bit more laboured in the second season, but then obviously he suffered the terrible misfortune of the car crash in January. George Best, 6 goals in 23 appearances before his impromptu departure in December, 4 in 19 in the league. Bobby Charlton, the top goal scorer, 7 goals in 41 games, 6 in 36 in the league, 2 of those as a substitute. Brings us on to the other players in the midfield. George Graham, as we mentioned earlier, another of those players given Scottish honours by Docherty. Now, he had been, you already mentioned his class as a midfielder. He'd been a great midfielder for Arsenal and brought this sense of calm with his assured and composed style. He was also given the captaincy under Tommy Docherty, but he struggled with the stage at United because, this is my phraseology, Paddy, and I don't know if you would agree or disagree with that, United didn't need the ice, they needed fire.
Yes.
And Graham brought ice, but United desperately needed some kind of fire in there. Yeah. Throughout the side, really, not just in midfield. And because of that, and because Graham wasn't the youthful upstart that United were kind of hoping, that they were hoping for that kind of energy in the midfield, because they didn't get it, and because Graham had been a veteran at Arsenal and probably seen his better days there, wasn't immediately popular with the United fans either. Not unpopular, I should say, but just didn't set the pulses racing as they might have hoped, and as he might have hoped as well. Trevor Anderson, Graham played 19 games, 18 in the league, and scored a single goal. Trevor Anderson, a midfielder who, you know, he was signed by O'Farrell from Portadown around the same time as McDougall, as we'll come on to in a moment. He was low profile compared to Davies and McDougall, to be fair. He came from Portadown. He made a decent impression in the reserves, playing mostly in the wide areas, so he was given a chance in the first team under Tommy Docherty. Yeah. He made 7 appearances, 5 as a sub in the league, and scored a single goal. Another of the lads who played a lot of reserve team football before coming into the first team was Peter Fletcher. Now, he's a Manchester-born forward. He made his debut towards the end of the season with Docherty not sold on McDougall. Fletcher hadn't been particularly prolific in the reserves either. He'd only scored 5 goals since October. You know, he wasn't pulling up a lot of trees, and maybe that's a lot to do with Aston's departure as well, the fact that United was struggling to bring through a lot of youth players. Fletcher making just 2 substitute appearances towards the end of the season. United really struggling with the forwards, it has to be said. From there, we go to Wyn Davies. Wyn Davies now, like we've already mentioned, a veteran City forward, Welsh international, famed for his stints at Bolton and Newcastle. And he'd had a fairly decent year at Main Road, but everyone was surprised when this offer came up from United. Again, Docherty, one of those that he inherited that he just wasn't a fan of. So Davies made 16 appearances in the league, 17 in all competitions, scored 4 goals. Docherty moved him on to Blackpool for £14,000 in June, which is a £10,000 or £11,000 loss in just under a year. But he was just not featuring in Docherty's plan, so he had to move him on. Willie Morgan on the wing, 4 goals in 44 appearances in all competitions, 4 in 39 in the league. Ian Storey, more before injury on the training ground, struck him down, 6 goals in 30 games. You would have probably gone on to be the top scorer, the most reliable informed player of the season, you would say, certainly in an attacking sense. 6 goals in 30 games, 5 in 26 in the league. And that should bring us on to the last two, which are Ted McDougall, first of all. Former Liverpool apprentice, McDougall makes his only 18 appearances and his only 5 goals are scored in this season. Now, he moved down the leagues from Liverpool and, as we said earlier, became renowned as a prolific scorer, first for York City and then for Bournemouth. He scored those 9 goals in an FA Cup win over Margate. I think Bournemouth won that game 11-0. Everyone in the country was watching to see what McDougall would do, if anyone would take a chance on him. Loads of clubs linked with him in the pre-season of 1972. No one took a chance on him, with United needing goals. Bournemouth obviously saw United coming in and charged a massive fee for him. McDougall giving big fanfare in the lots of newspaper press over his arrival. O'Farrell gave him a fair shake. Tommy Docherty did not take to McDougall even less than you would say Wyn Davies, really. And they had a very fractured relationship, to say the least. Dennis Lowe, 2 goals in 14 games to see out his United career, 1 in 11 in the league, which very disappointing end to his United career. But obviously at this point, he was very very injured, suffering these injections every game, barely training. Doherty even accused him of cheating his teammates, which was a bit unfair. I think Lowe was desperate to help them get out of the plight that they were in, and desperate not to end his United career in the way that it ended. He was heartbroken by that. But obviously, as anyone who's a keen historian of United United stories will know, Dennis Lowe's relationship with Manchester United, firstly, isn't over as an ambassador, but secondly, on a playing sense, there's a little bit more to come just yet. Brian Kidd, 4 goals in 25 appearances in all competitions, 4 in 22 in the league. Again, Kidd would have hoped that there wouldn't be the need for McDougall or for Wyn Davies, that he would be the one to be given that responsibility, but he just wasn't. And that was the case. Lou Macari, quickly as we come to that, he was on his way to Liverpool before Paddy Creran hijacked the move and got to Manchester. Unlike some of the others, Macari was a bright young thing, a harasser in the front line. You might say in the form of Carlos Tevez, even the way that he harried opposition defences. He was an established international, scored on his debut against West Ham. He wore Dennis Lowe's number 10 shirt while Dennis Lowe took to the field wearing number 4. A very unfamiliar sight indeed for anyone watching that. But then, as the season wore on, Macari ended up with 5 in 16 in all competitions. In the league, I should say. Struggled with the weight of expectation. He was the man now expected to deliver all the goals scored by the 3 departed Ballon d'Or winners, as we mentioned earlier. This is a squad picture from towards the end of the season, where you got Tommy Doherty in there and Tommy Cav alongside him, and Pat Creran on the other side as well. That's how the side looks towards the end of the season. United's colours.
Sorry. Carry on. Carry on. There's just a couple of points I'd like to make in a moment.
Just the red and the an excuse to put this beautiful shirt up, the yellow shirt, which United, I think they're actually bringing one back for the 22-23 season. I don't know if it's quite in homage to their horrendous form wearing this for a couple of seasons, but it's a lovely kit nonetheless. Paddy, you're going to speak about the squad.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the season, two little points in the season. I think it would be remiss of us not to say that this was to be the final season of John Fitzpatrick. United's first substitute, I think. Is that right?
Apart from the first official substitute, because of course David Gaskell had come on as a substitute in the Charity Shield. The first live substitute.
That's right. He'd been sort of virtually pulled out of the crowd, hasn't he? Hadn't he, Gaskell? That's right. First official substitute, and one who definitely had been plagued, like his fellow Aberdonian, Dennis Lowe. This was the end. He was to retire. I think pretty soon after the 72 season drew to an end. That was one thing, but just to show that there was, it wasn't all doom and gloom around Manchester United at the time. I can remember in Manchester, there was the mischievous quiz question. Can you name 2 United players who have the same name as a flower? And a lot of people got Dennis Violet. A lot of people said the second one, is it Jackie Blanche Flower? Well, there's no such flower as a Blanche Flower. So who was the second Manchester United player who had the same name as a flower?
No.
McDougall.
No.
There's a famous brand of flour, McDougall's. that you make bread out of. Anyway, that was... So, you know, we used to tell... I wasn't the United supporter, but the people... of Manchester used to cheer each other up by catching the mates in the pub with that catch question. Anyway, I just thought I'd remind you of that. Even though you'd never heard of the flower, McDougal's flower.
I could be sure that there was a Rose who played for United. That might have come after.
Henry Rose was a journalist.
No, there were a couple of lads called Rose. Matthew Rose. And there was a... Yeah.
Oh, well, I might have known I couldn't get that one past you.
No, but that was late obviously. 1973. Yeah. I don't think they were born in 1973. Yeah, Fitzpatrick, you're quite right. 147 appearances and 10 goals. He retired with great player. And should really have been that buy in the United midfield, what they were desperately needed. He provided it when he was fit, for sure, and he would be sorely missed. And one of those really understated misses as United were going to kick on into the season, because he would have been a natural player to step into that void. The team... This is how it looked. Although you would say towards the end of the season that obviously you've got Forsyth coming in on the right, and then Holton in the middle as well. You know, these were the players that would have made a significant contribution to United.
Yeah.
But because of the fact, and obviously you'd have Dennis Law, George Best, David Sadler. There are a lot of players in there, like Tommy O'Neill, Steve James, he is in there, Mick Martin, another one. A lot of players who made, you know, in the high teens of appearances, but they just don't figure more.
Yeah, exactly. This is probably the most difficult typical team you've ever had to do in this whole series, because as you were talking earlier about the players who'd made a contribution to the season, I lost count in the 20s. So it just kind of serves to illustrate just how transitional a time this was at Manchester United.
Yeah, near 30 players. It might well be 30 that played a significant number. And you've got a couple of players like Charlton and Buchan and Willie Morgan who played practically every game. Yeah.
But then you struggle to find staples of the diet, you know, other than those, you know.
Yeah, which a contributing factor for their difficult form, of course. Average attendance this season, down slightly from 47,000 to 46,703. We've already mentioned a couple of times Bobby Charlton, the top goal scorer, with 7 goals, 6 of those in the league. But by the way, I'm putting that as a 4-3-3, which is how the season started. It transitioned into a 4-4-2, a flat 4-4-2, which it would come primarily after Story Moore was injured, and you would have like the likes of Trevor Anderson on the left. So that's how that formation would have looked towards the end of the season, the 4-4-2. You mentioned some of those players who were now at the end. Fitzpatrick is one that's gone. Tony Dunn, Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, practically the end for David Sadler. He only plays a few more games for United. The key results for this season, there's really only one that I look out this season that sticks out like a sore thumb. I mean, yes, of course, you've got the 4-1 defeat at home to Spurs. You've got the 1-0 loss at Chelsea where Bobby Charlton retired. But the headline result from the season is the 5-0 defeat at Crystal Palace. There's no avoiding that.
I'm afraid so,
Elsewhere in football, Liverpool won the league. That's their 8th title, so they're now branching out as the most successful British team in history. Because obviously the league titles are in the single figures at this point. Sunderland famously won the FA Cup. Spurs, not so famously, but famously enough for them, won the League Cup. The Football League announced one big change that was to have serious ramifications for Manchester United in the future. They were going to implement, to make the league a little bit more exciting, Paddy, they were going to implement a new system, a new relegation system, because 2 up and 2 down wasn't exciting enough. So they were going to make it 3 up and 3 down from the following season. But fortunately for United, they finished in 18th. So even with 3 down, they weren't going to struggle. And now they got a new manager, lots of money spent. They're going to be safe and kicking on to better things. because they are too good to go down. Right, with that in the bank, and that's a 72-73 season. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please give it a like and subscribe on YouTube. Obviously, you can join in the conversation in the comment section as well. If you're listening back to the audio podcast as well, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. We will be back next time to talk about Manchester United 73-74 season.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.